Usually when we talk about like a medical diagnosis, there's this expectation of mechanical precision.
Oh, sure. Yeah, like a broken bone or something.
Exactly. You break your arm, the x-ray shows this jagged white line right across the bone, and the doctor just taps the screen and says, "Well, there's the fracture. It's binary. It's clean."
And that binary nature is comforting. Honestly, we are so wired to prefer threats that are, visible, localized, and easily categorized into just broken or fixed.
Right. But the moment you step out of that simple localized trauma and into the world of systemic collapse, say like an autoimmune cascade, or even looking totally outside the human body at a supply chain failure or an ecosystem dying off, that x-ray machine is entirely
Yeah,
useless.
completely useless.
You find yourself staring at a diagnostic landscape that is just incredibly murky. You can't point to a single broken bone when the entire organism is, quietly failing from a thousand invisible pressures.
Which is pretty much the absolute definition of diagnostic muddy waters.
Yeah.
And historically, I mean, science has really struggled to map that murkiness.
Yeah, and that feeling, that complex, unmappable, kind of terrifying sense of systemic fragility, is exactly where we are anchoring our deep dive today. We're looking at the actual mechanics of survival and the anatomy of catastrophic collapse across literally everything around you.
Such a massive topic.
It is. And today's source material is this groundbreaking paper published literally today, March 14th, 2026. It's titled "The Viability Grammar Toward a General Theory of Persistence in Complex Adaptive Systems."
Quite a mouthful.
Right. But it's fascinating. It was authored by Dr. Bechara Sahail, who is this independent scholar, a systems researcher, and a physician based in the Caribbean. And get this, he co-developed this whole framework with an advanced AI.
Yeah, specifically ChatGPT 5.3.
Right, using it as this highly critical analytical sparring partner, which we will definitely get into later because the methodology there is wild.
It really is. And, the ambition of this paper is just staggering. Dr. Sakili is attempting to answer the ultimate question of persistence, which is why do some systems manage to absorb shocks, adapt, and survive under extreme pressure, while other, like seemingly robust systems, completely and irreversibly collapse?
Right, so we're talking about why one single human cell survives a viral load while the surrounding tissue just necrotizes, or why a massive multi-billion-dollar corporation can evaporate in a month while a tiny local business survives a depression.
Exactly. Or why one coral reef bounces back from a temperature spike while a neighboring reef bleaches and turns into, a dead calcium desert.
So by the end of this deep dive, you, the listener, are going to have a unified grammar-like, a literal vocabulary and mathematical syntax to map out the survival of any system in your life. But to understand why Dr. Sikula even had to invent a new grammar, we first have to look at the Babel-like confusion that has plagued system science for the last 80 years.
Yeah, the Tower of Babel is a great way to describe it, because the problem hasn't been a lack of observation or like a lack of data.
Right, we have plenty of data.
Tons of it. The problem is that the scientific disciplines studying survival have been completely siloed. The paper identifies five distinct scientific traditions that have basically spent decades independently trying to solve this exact persistence problem.
Let's track that intellectual lineage here because it really reveals the blind spot. So, the first major attempt to systemize survival happens in the mid-20th century with cybernetics.
Right, Norbert Wiener and W. Ross Ashby.
Yeah, and cybernetics was born out of very practical mechanical problems during World War II. They were trying to build automated anti-aircraft guns that could actually predict the evasive maneuvers of enemy pilots.
And that mechanical origin is so crucial to understand. Cybernetics gave us the foundational language of control and communication. They basically formalized the concept of the feedback loop.
Oh, like a thermostat.
It's exactly like a thermostat. How a system senses an output, feeds that information back into itself, and then adjusts its next input to maintain a stable state. And from this, Ashby derived what he called the law of requisite variety.
Okay, break down requisite variety for us. What does that actually mean?
It fundamentally states that the internal regulatory complexity of a system must match or exceed the complexity of the environment it's trying to navigate.
Okay, wait. So,
So if an environment can throw 10 distinct types of physical disturbances at a fighter jet, the jet's control systems must be capable of at least 10 distinct compensatory responses. If it only has 9, well, that 10th disturbance destroys the system.
wow. Okay, so you have to be as complex as the problem you're fighting. That makes sense. But what's the limitation there?
The limitation was that cybernetics was largely built from machines. I mean, a thermostat or an anti-aircraft predictor doesn't grow, it doesn't reproduce, it doesn't evolve.
Right, they're static.
Yeah. So ecologists in the 1970s, who were looking at living, breathing environments, realized that the cybernetic framework just wasn't enough to explain biological survival.
Which brings us to the second tradition, ecological resilience, pioneered by scientists like C.S. Holling. They were looking at things like spruce budworm outbreaks in boreal forests. Because a forest doesn't have a rigid mechanical goal like a thermostat set to 72 degrees.
No, it has phases. Holling introduced the idea of the adaptive cycle.
Right, this concept that ecosystems naturally move through phases of like rapid growth, conservation, then a sudden release or collapse, and finally reorganization.
Yeah, and resilience theory taught us that systems operate within what they called basins of attraction.
I love this concept. Let's visualize it. Think of a landscape with several deep valleys, right?
Perfect, yeah.
As long as a forest stays in its specific valley, its basin of attraction, it remains a forest even if a fire burns down half the trees. But if a shock is so massive that it pushes the ecosystem all the way over the ridge and into a neighboring valley, it crosses this irreversible threshold.
Right, it shifts into a totally new state. It might become a barren grassland instead of a forest.
Okay, so we've got engineers and ecologists. Who's next?
Well, while ecologists mapped out these basins and thresholds, mathematicians looked at it and found the descriptions way too qualitative, too fuzzy. This led to the third tradition in the 1990s, which is viability theory.
Right. Primarily developed by the French mathematician Jean-Pierre Aubin.
Exactly. Aubin basically stripped away all the biology and looked purely at the mathematics of dynamical systems evolving under strict, non-negotiable constraints.
And his work is incredibly rigorous. Viability theory asks us a purely geometric question, which is, given a set of hard boundaries, does a set of control actions exist that can keep the system's trajectory inside the safe zone over time?
Yes. It mapped the geometry of survival, but, this is a big but, it was highly abstract and largely ignored how a system actually knows where it is within that geometry.
Ah, right. It assumed perfect knowledge.
Exactly. And that blind spot regarding knowledge and information processing is what summoned the cognitive scientists into the arena.
Which is the fourth tradition, predictive processing. This is heavily associated with the neuroscientist Carl Friston.
Right. Friston flipped the paradigm by looking at organisms fundamentally as prediction engines.
Active inference. The idea that your brain isn't just like passively receiving signals from your eyes and ears. It is constantly generating a model of the world and predicting what it should be sensing next.
Yes. And biological survival, in Friston's view, is simply the process of minimizing surprise.
Minimizing surprise. I love how poetic that sounds for neuroscience.
It really is. If a system's internal model constantly generates predictions that fail to match sensory reality, the system is in a state of high surprise. And chronically high surprise leads to physical decay and death.
So this tradition highlighted how deeply perception and physical action are coupled. You act upon the world to make your sensory inputs match your internal predictions.
Exactly. So now we have the engineers, the ecologists, the mathematicians, and the neuroscientists.
But there is one missing piece here. What happens when millions of individual prediction engines, like millions of people, have to coordinate their survival together?
Right. And that brings in the fifth tradition from the social scientists.
Yeah.
Specifically, institutional governance. Championed by the Nobel laureate Eleanor Ostrom.
Ostrom studied the tragedy of the commons, right?
Yes. She documented how human communities, whether they're fishing villages in Turkey or irrigation collectives in Nepal, how they create complex rules, norms, and institutions to manage shared resources without destroying them. She looked at how societies govern themselves under uncertainty, basically studying collective regulation.
Okay, so let's visualize the disaster of this fragmentation. Because having five different schools of thought sounds great until you realize they don't overlap. I want to build a scenario for the listener that isn't just abstract theory. Imagine a massive hurricane making landfall on a highly developed coastal city.
Oh, a textbook complex crisis.
Right. So the cybernetic engineer is downtown looking at the city's power grid, measuring the automated feedback loops, trying to reroute electricity around downed transformers.
While the ecologist is out in the coastal wetlands, measuring how the storm surge is pushing the saltwater marsh out of its historical basin of attraction.
Exactly. And the viability mathematician is running structural load equations on the city's suspension bridges to see if the wind shear crosses a constraint boundary.
And then you have the cognitive scientist analyzing the evacuation behavior of the citizens, looking at how they update their internal risk models based on weather alerts.
And finally, the political scientist is sitting in FEMA headquarters analyzing the institutional resource distribution. Every single one of those experts is studying the exact same phenomenon.
The survival of the city under extreme pressure.
Yes, but they cannot talk to each other. It's the classic blind man and the elephant. One has the trunk, one has the leg, and they all think they're studying different animals. The engineer's math doesn't apply to the ecologist's wetlands, and the cognitive scientist's models mean literally nothing to the political scientist's institutional analysis.
And that is the problem. If your policymakers and your scientists are all speaking mutually unintelligible languages, managing a crisis that cascades across all these domains becomes mathematically impossible.
This is the profound liability that Dr. Saley is addressing. The viability grammar is the first rigorous attempt to build a Rosetta Stone for these five domains. He extracts the underlying universal mechanics from every single one of those traditions to build a unified alphabet of survival.
A single grammar that applies to the power grid, the wetlands, the bridges, the people, and the institutions.
So let's learn the alphabet. The paper isolates seven irreducible elements. These are the fundamental, non-negotiable components that determine whether a system persists or collapses. Break them down for us.
Okay, the first element is C, constraints. These are the hard, physical, or logical limits of reality. They define the absolute boundary between existence and non-existence for a given system.
Give me some examples of constraints.
Sure. For a biological cell, the constraint is the structural integrity of its lipid membrane and Strix pH ranges. For a structural bridge, it's the tensile limit of steel. For your bank account, it's hitting $0 when your rent is due. If the system state crosses the constraint boundary, the system fundamentally ceases to be what it was. It collapses.
Okay, got it. The second element is M, margins. Margins represent the buffer zone. It is the quantifiable distance between where your system currently operates and that catastrophic constraint boundary.
Right. So if the constraint of a commercial airline is running out of fuel mid-flight, the margin is the extra 45 minutes of reserve fuel loaded into the tanks beyond the calculated flight path.
Margins are your slack in the system, your breathing room.
Exactly. Element three is O, optionality.
Now, optionality is different from margins, right?
Yes. While margins measure your spatial or temporal distance to the edge, optionality measures the topological degrees of freedom you possess. It is the number of different viable future pathways or states you can access from your current position.
Okay, so a system with high optionality can pivot. Like a business with multiple diverse revenue streams has high optionality. If one product fails, they just shift to another.
Right, but a business that relies on a single mega client has an optionality of near zero. They are locked onto a single trajectory.
Which brings us to the active antagonist of the system. Element four is D, disturbances. These are the thermodynamic, energetic, or informational shocks pushing the system around.
Disturbances can be external, like a sudden spike in interest rates hitting a housing market, or they can be internal, like a genetic mutation destabilizing a cell's replication cycle. They are the forces constantly threatening to erode your margins.
Element five is P, perception. This is the sensory architecture. It's the data gathering mechanisms that sample the environment and the internal state to estimate what the disturbances are actually doing.
So for a nation state, perception is its intelligence agencies, its seismology labs, its economic census bureaus.
And for a human immune system, it's the dendritic cells identifying foreign antigens.
Exactly. Now, once a disturbance is perceived, the system must act. Element six is R, regulation. Regulation encompasses the actual physical, chemical, or institutional actions taken to counteract the disturbance and steer the system.
It is the central bank raising interest rates. It is the sweat glands activating to cool the body down. Regulation is the expenditure of energy to alter the system's trajectory.
And finally, element seven is X, system state or trajectory. This is the realized physical path the system actually takes through time as a consequence of all the other elements interacting.
It is the literal coordinate of the system at any given microsecond.
Right.
Okay, I want to anchor these seven letters, C, M, O, D, P, R, and X, into a visceral mechanical reality for you listening. Let's build a scenario that maps perfectly onto the math. Imagine you are driving a heavy truck down a winding, icy mountain road in the dead of winter at night.
Oh, the stakes are absolute, and the environment is highly volatile. Perfect scenario.
In this scenario, see, the constraints are governed by the laws of physics. It's the friction coefficient of the asphalt, and geographically, it is the steep drop-off of the cliff on your right and the solid rock wall on your left. If the mass of your truck crosses that geometric boundary,
the system suffers a terminal collapse. You fall off the cliff.
Exactly. Now, M, the margins, is the physical distance between your tires and the edge of that cliff. If your right tire is 3 feet from the edge, your margin is exactly 3 feet. It's a quantifiable buffer.
And D, the disturbances, are the kinetic forces attacking that margin. It's the patch of black ice instantly dropping your friction to near zero. It's the 50-mile-per-hour crosswind violently applying lateral force to the side of your truck, basically trying to push you across the margin and over the constraint.
And you combat those forces through P, perception. Your headlights illuminating the ice, the rods and cones in your retina processing the visual data, your inner ear sensing the lateral G forces of the skid, and the haptic feedback of the steering column vibrating in your hands.
Right. And that perception data feeds instantly into R, regulation. My central nervous system fires. My arms apply opposing torque to the steering wheel, turning into the skid. My foot applies precise hydraulic pressure to the anti-lock brakes. I am expending energy to counter the crosswind.
So what about optionality, or where does that fit on the mountain road?
Optionality is the topological freedom of the road ahead. If the mountain pass suddenly widens into a three-lane straightaway, my optionality explodes. I have multiple paths to choose from. I can swerve left, right, or pull over safely.
But if I enter a narrow single-lane tunnel with a massive semi-truck bearing down behind me, my optionality drops to zero. I am locked into a singular, hyper-constrained trajectory, even if my margins on either side are technically stable for the moment.
Yes. And finally, X, the system state, is the actual physical rubber laid down on the asphalt. It is the exact trajectory the truck takes through time and space.
So if we condense this entire grammar into a single mechanical directive, survival is simply this. Keeping your state, X, inside the constraints, C, despite the kinetic forces of disturbances, D, by using your sensory perception, P, and mechanical regulation, R, to maintain your spatial margins, M, and your navigational optionality, O.
It is incredibly elegant. But here is where Dr. Saley really elevates this from just a simple list of variables into a predictive science. Because, having an alphabet is basically useless if you don't understand the syntax.
Right, letters don't mean anything until you combine them into words and sentences.
Exactly. You have to understand how these seven elements structurally bind to one another. Because in complex systems, these elements don't just bounce around randomly. The paper maps their interactions using a specific structure from finite geometry called the Fano plane.
Okay, the Fano plane. We need to explain this carefully. Let's visualize it.
The Fano plane is this profound mathematical tool. Just imagine a triangle.
Okay, I have a triangle.
Now, draw a circle perfectly inscribed inside that triangle so it touches the three sides. You have three points at the corners of the triangle, three points where the circle touches the sides, and one point in the absolute dead center.
3 + 3 + 1. That's seven distinct points.
Mapping perfectly to our seven elements.
Wow, okay.
And in this specific geometry, there are seven distinct lines connecting these points. The mathematical rule of the Fano plane is that every single line contains exactly three points, and every two points define exactly one line, which inevitably intersects a third point.
Wait. I need to visualize the implication of that. If every two points automatically dictate a third point, it means you can never just have a pair of elements interacting in isolation. You
Right.
can never just have an action and a reaction. The geometry literally forces them to be mediated by a third variable.
This is the core architectural brilliance of the viability grammar. It completely destroys the illusion of simple cause and effect in complex systems. It proves that systemic governance operates entirely through what Saheeli calls irreducible triads.
I want to push back on this a little because human intuition is deeply wired for pairs. We think in binary cause and effect. If I drop a glass, it shatters. Gravity and impact. If the crosswind hits my truck, which is the disturbance, my hands turn the wheel, which is regulation. That feels like a complete pair. Why is a triad mathematically necessary?
I get that. But the pair is an illusion created by taking the third element for granted. Let's look at your crosswind and steering wheel. Disturbance and regulation, BDR. If we place them on the Fano plane, the geometry dictates they're irrevocably linked by a third node. Perception, P.
Meaning if I remove P.
If you are driving the truck completely blindfolded with earplugs in and your hands completely numbed by the cold,
Oh, wow. Okay.
you have a massive disturbance hitting the truck. You have total mechanical capacity for regulation in the steering wheel. But without perception bridging the two, your regulation is totally uncoupled from reality.
Because I don't know which way the wind is blowing.
Exactly. You might steer left when the wind is already pushing you left, actually accelerating your death. The systemic dynamic simply cannot exist without all three points of the triad locking together.
That makes perfect sense. Let's look at another one of these irreducible triads from the paper, because they act like diagnostic lenses. The text highlights the early warning dynamics triad.
Right, this triad links margins, M, disturbances, D, and perception, P. Its entire function is the detection of buffer erosion.
Let's apply this to a massive institutional failure just to show how scalable this is. Think about the global supply chain crisis and the semiconductor shortage back in 2021.
Oh, that's a perfect case study.
For years, major auto manufacturers had been optimizing for just-in-time manufacturing. They intentionally shrank their inventory margins, M, to near zero to save warehousing costs. They had no stockpile of microchips. The disturbance, D, was the cascading effect of factory shutdowns and shipping bottlenecks from the pandemic.
Now look at the third node of that triad, perception, P. The auto manufacturers had really sophisticated monitoring, but their perception mechanisms were calibrated to highly stable, predictable environments.
Right.
So they perceived the disturbance, but they profoundly miscalculated the rate at which the disturbance would consume their non-existent margins.
Because the margin was already so incredibly thin, the moment the disturbance was perceived, it was actually too late to act. The triad broke down. Timing and information flow are everything. The warning system functioned, but it was warning a system that had literally no buffer left to absorb the shock.
Which naturally leads to another crucial triad he maps out, adaptive capacity. This connects margins, M, optionality, O, and regulation, R.
This is the forward-looking triad, right?
Yes. Adaptive capacity is about how a system utilizes its current regulatory actions. R, not just to survive the immediate disturbance right in front of its face, but to proactively manufacture deeper margins, M, and broader optionality, O, for the future.
So if a company spends 100% of its cash flow, its regulation, just to keep the lights on and pay the interest on its debt, it is surviving the present moment.
Barely.
Right, barely. But it is generating zero margins and zero optionality for next year. Its adaptive capacity is zero. The moment a new disturbance arrives, it will shatter.
And you see this everywhere. The Fano plane basically organizes all of reality into these interlocking triangles. But Dr. Sally doesn't stop at just the geometry of the seven elements. He introduces a concept that redefines what these elements actually are. It's called the triadic generative hypothesis.
This is where the paper shifts from like mechanical engineering into deep systemic philosophy. He essentially argues that these seven elements are not created equal. They aren't just seven distinct ingredients thrown into a pot. Four of them are essentially ghosts.
Right, they're derivatives.
Yeah, the entire grammar actually emerges from an underlying root structure of just three fundamental dimensions.
The primitive dimensions of reality. For any system to exist and navigate the universe, it requires only three irreducible properties: constraints, perception, and regulation. C, P, and R.
Ontology, epistemology, and praxis.
Let's define those terms for everyone, because they carry immense weight in the paper. Constraints, C, represent ontology, the study of being. It is the fundamental physical reality of the environment, the gravity, the thermodynamics, the physical mass of the system.
Right, what actually is.
Exactly. Perception, P, represents epistemology, the theory of knowledge. It is how the system extracts information from that physical reality. And regulation R is praxis, the application of action. It is how the system exerts force back onto reality.
Reality and knowledge and action. If those are the only primitive dimensions, what happens to the other four elements? Like, what is a disturbance?
Okay.
A disturbance, D, is not an inherent property of the system itself. It is merely a forcing field, an energetic fluctuation in the ontological environment, the constraints that impinges upon the system.
What about the system state, X? Like my truck leaving tire tracks in the snow.
The state, X, has no independent, forward-looking existence. It is purely an artifact. It is just the historical, physical record left behind by the continuous interaction of your knowledge, P, and your action, R, against the reality of the road, Z.
But here is the massive conceptual leap that completely changed how I view my own life. Margins M and optionality O are not physical objects. You cannot weigh a margin on a scale. You cannot put optionality in a box.
Well, no, you can't. They are emergent relational properties. They are mathematical shadows.
Think about this. A margin only exists as a metric of distance between two vectors, your current state, X, and the physical constraint, C. It's like measuring the distance between two moving cars. The distance itself isn't made of atoms. It's a relational fact.
Optionality operates the exact same way. It is the calculated volume of viable future states you can reach, derived entirely from comparing your current regulatory toolkit to the constrained geometry.
The implication of this is profound for human behavior. I really want you to hear this. If you feel trapped in your career or boxed into a corner in a relationship, you often feel like you have run out of options. And people spend enormous amounts of energy trying to directly acquire or basically buy optionality.
But the math dictates that optionality is just a shadow. You cannot alter a shadow directly.
You can only alter the objects casting the shadow.
Yes. If you want to increase your optionality, you only have three primitive levers you can pull. You must either alter the fundamental constraints of your reality.
Which is incredibly difficult, like trying to change the laws of physics or the core structure of an entire industry.
Very hard. Or you must upgrade your epistemology, your perception. You must learn to see data, trends, or social dynamics that you were previously totally blind to. Or you must upgrade your praxis, your regulation. You must acquire new physical, technical, or communicative skills so your actions just have more leverage.
When you improve your perception or your regulatory capacity, the mathematical volume of your reachable future states just effortlessly expands. The shadow of optionality grows larger as a direct consequence of upgrading your primitive dimensions.
It's empowering when you look at it that way. Now, to truly grasp the mechanics of how these dimensions govern survival, the paper builds a formal mathematical model. We need to visualize the actual geometry of survival, utilizing geometric control theory.
Okay, let's paint this picture. Imagine a massive multidimensional topology. The constraints define a physical viability domain. Picture a sprawling, irregularly shaped bowl.
A bowl, yeah. And the absolute rim of this bowl is the constraint boundary. Outside the bowl is structural death.
So the goal is to keep the state of your system. Let's picture it as a heavy steel marble rolling around safely inside the bowl.
Now add the environmental forces. The disturbances are invisible vector fields, like gravity wells or really powerful currents of wind blowing across the surface of the bowl, constantly trying to drag the marble up toward the rim.
Regulation is my control vector field. It is my internal engine, pushing back against the wind, trying to steer the marble down toward the deep, safe center of the bowl. And perception is my radar system, constantly pinging the topology of the bowl so I know exactly how close the marble is to the rim.
Right. And the deeper the marble sits in the bowl, the larger the spatial buffer to the rim. That is your margin. And if the marble is right in the center, it can be pushed in 360 different directions without going over the edge. That is massive optionality.
But if the wind pushes the marble right up against the rim, your optionality collapses to perhaps only one or two narrow paths that run exactly parallel to the edge.
And Dr. Sahili synthesizes this entire geometric dance into a single brutal equation known as the viability functional.
This equation basically determines the total survival probability of a system at any given moment. I'm looking at the paper right now, and the equation is written as V star equals M times O times R times P. But I notice there is a little squiggle, a tilde, over the M, the O, the R, and the P. What does that signify mathematically?
The tilde indicates that these variables are normalized. In mathematics, this means we map their raw values onto a scale between exactly 0 and 1.
Okay.
So if your margins are completely full, mathematically infinite relative to the threat, the M is 1. If your margins are entirely depleted, M is 0. The exact same applies to optionality, perception, and regulation.
So total viability equals margin times optionality times regulation times perception, all scale between 0 and 1. The most terrifying aspect of this equation isn't the variables, it's the operators between them. It is multiplicative.
It is not additive. You don't get to add a strong margin to a weak perception to get an okay average score.
If it's multiplicative, it means that if any single one of those normalized variables drops to absolute zero.
One times zero is zero. Total systemic viability instantaneously becomes zero.
This mathematically explains the sudden, just bewildering collapse of massive, seemingly invincible empires and megacorporations.
Oh, absolutely.
Let's look at the corporate collapse of Nokia or BlackBerry when the iPhone launched.
A classic zero-variable collapse.
Right. They had massive margins. Their M was near one. They had billions in cash reserves. They had immense regulatory capacity, R, was near one. They had tens of thousands of the best engineers in global supply chains. They had optionality to build basically any hardware they wanted.
But their perception P of what the consumer market actually wanted, the shift from a phone with a physical keyboard to a pocket computer with a glass screen, dropped to zero.
Their sensory apparatus completely failed to map the new topology of the market. And because the equation is multiplicative, billions of dollars in margins and world-class engineering could not save them. When P equals zero, viability equals zero. The marble flew right over the rim of the bowl.
Exactly. But the paper doesn't just apply this math to corporate history. It makes an astounding claim about the universality of this geometry. Dr. Saheeli details a concept called cross-scale recurrence.
This is the realization that the viability functional is completely scale independent. The grammar repeats like a mathematical fractal across every single layer of reality. The exact same tilled variables that govern a dying corporation govern a dying biological cell.
We really need to trace this fractal. It's beautiful. Let's pick a single specific disturbance, say a novel, highly aggressive respiratory virus, and watch how the exact same mathematical grammar fights it across five different scales of existence.
Okay, let's do it.
We begin at the cellular scale. The virus enters the body and attacks a single lung cell. The cell's constraints are maintaining its internal protein synthesis and pH balance. The virus is the disturbance.
And the cell's perception mechanisms are its surface receptor proteins detecting the viral antigens.
Right. Its regulation is the activation of intracellular enzymes and messenger RNA to produce antiviral proteins. If the viral replication outpaces the enzyme production, the cell's margin collapses, it lyses, and it dies.
But the death of that cell basically becomes a massive disturbance for the next scale up, the physiological system, the whole organism.
Now your entire body is fighting. The constraints are your core body temperature and blood oxygen saturation. Your perception is the vast network of dendritic cells and your hypothalamus detecting systemic inflammation.
And your regulation is a full-scale immune cascade, raising body temperature to create a fever, generating billions of targeted antibodies, and triggering behavioral lethargy to basically force you to conserve energy.
But if the fever regulation fails to clear the virus and fluid fills the lungs, the physiological margins collapse.
Mm.
The patient goes into respiratory failure. This local failure now scales up and becomes a disturbance for the third level, the ecological or population scale.
So the virus is now transmitting across an entire city. The constraint of the population is maintaining demographic stability and a functioning workforce.
The perception is epidemiological surveillance, testing centers, and wastewater monitoring. The regulation is the structural alteration of the environment, social distancing, quarantines, and vaccine distribution.
But if transmission outpaces containment, the infected population floods the fourth scale, the institutional system, the hospital networks.
Right. The hospital's constraint is its physical and personnel capacity. Its margin is the number of empty ICU beds and available ventilators. Its perception is its triage and admissions date network.
And its regulation is the rapid reallocation of doctors, canceling elective surgeries, and calling in emergency supplies.
If the hospital margins hit zero, the health system fractures, which instantly transmits the shockwave up to the final macro scale, the civilizational system, the sovereign state.
The state's constraints are macroeconomic stability and basic social order. Its perception relies on national intelligence, economic forecasting, and global health data.
And its regulation involves massive blunt force instruments, closing international borders, deploying the military for logistics, and injecting trillions of dollars of fiat currency to prevent total economic implosion.
What Dr. Saheeli reveals here is that the doctor injecting antivirals into the patient's arm, the hospital administrator converting a cafeteria into an overflow ward, and the central bank governor printing stimulus money are all fundamentally executing the exact same mathematical function.
Yes, they are all attempting to deploy R, informed by P, to restore M, to keep X within C, against the relentless pressure of D.
It just strips away the illusion that biology, economics, and sociology operate on completely different physics. It is all the exact same geometric battle.
And because it is the same battle, the ways in which these systems lose the battle are also universally identical.
The paper outlines three specific failure modes. So if you are a systems analyst, a doctor, or just someone trying to figure out why your personal life is falling apart, you are looking for these three systemic pathologies.
The first failure mode is margin collapse.
We touched on this earlier. This is the phenomenon of running way too lean. Your perception works, your regulation works, but your buffer has shrunk to a microscopic sliver.
Right. A classic historical example is the catastrophic vulnerability of highly optimized, just-in-time global supply chains. Prior to major disruptions, shipping companies and manufacturers basically optimized away all redundancies just to maximize quarterly profits. They eliminated warehouse storage. The margin was functionally zero.
So when a single container ship gets wedged in the Suez Canal, which is a relatively localized disturbance, the entire global logistics network cascades into failure within days. The system was so brittle that it required a state of permanent perfection just to survive.
The second failure mode is perception failure. This is systemic blindness.
So you have margins and you have a functional steering wheel, but your sensors are fundamentally distorted or totally disconnected from the reality of the constraints.
There is literally no better example of this than the 2008 global financial crisis. The massive investment banks had trillions in capital. They had immense regulatory infrastructure.
But their perception mechanisms, the credit rating agencies, and their internal risk models were utterly corrupted by the complexity of those collateralized debt obligations. They looked at toxic subprime mortgages and mathematically perceived them as AAA, risk-free assets.
The financial landscape was completely littered with massive disturbances, but because their P dropped to zero, the regulatory mechanisms never activated. They drove the global economy off a cliff at full speed because the sensory apparatus insisted the road was straight.
And the third failure mode is perhaps the most tragic: regulatory deficit paralysis.
In this mode, your margins might be totally intact, and your perception is functioning flawlessly. You see the disturbance clearly. You know exactly where the constraint boundary is. But the institutional or physical mechanisms required to execute the necessary action are broken, fragmented, or just under-resourced.
We are living through the ultimate global example of regulatory deficit right now: anthropogenic climate change. Our civilizational perception is incredibly high. Thousands of climate scientists have mapped the planetary constraint boundaries with staggering precision.
We track the carbon parts per million daily. We perceive the storms, the melting ice shelves, the shifting jet streams. We see the rim of the bowl approaching rapidly.
But we suffer from a profound regulatory deficit. Global governance is deeply fragmented across competing nation states. The mechanism to collectively grab the steering wheel and drastically alter our carbon trajectory simply does not exist in a unified, enforceable way. We are perfectly aware of the cliff, yet we lack the mechanical linkage to turn the vehicle.
Which brings us to a really crucial, actionable definition of governance. Mm. Whether you were talking about corporate governance, national politics, or simply managing your own physical health, governance is nothing more than viability management.
It is the deliberate daily practice of maintaining constraint awareness, investing heavy resources into upgrading your perception mechanisms, and vigorously maintaining your adaptive regulatory capacity. Think about your own life, your own work, or your own household right now. Which of these three failure modes are you most vulnerable to? Are you running with zero margins? Are your sensors dull? Or are you just paralyzed to act?
It's an incredibly tight, robust theory. In fact, you could argue it's almost too neat, which is exactly why the author did something completely unconventional before publishing it.
Yes, the methodology. Because building a theory of everything is a very dangerous game in science. It invites immediate accusations of being overly generalized or mathematically superficial.
So Dr. Safley didn't just publish the paper and wait for the academic community to tear it apart. He used the very AI he built the theory with, ChatGPT 5.3, to simulate a brutal, highly sophisticated, hostile peer review committee.
He essentially instructed the AI to adopt the personas of top-tier reviewers from various disciplines, ecology, mathematics, cognitive science, and ordered it to aggressively attack the vulnerabilities in his own manuscript.
And he published those unvarnished, hostile critiques directly in the appendix of the final paper.
I read through them, and they do not pull punches at all.
No, they are surgically precise. For instance, the simulated reviewer 1 attacks the concept of cross-scale recurrence, calling it conceptual overreach. The AI argues that comparing the viability of a biological cell to the viability of a nation state is merely a suggestive heuristic-like, a neat metaphor, but lacks the rigid empirical operationalization required of a true physical law.
And reviewer 2 attacks a practical application, citing a lack of operationalization. The AI basically says, Dr. Sarley, your math is elegant on paper, but how do you actually extract a hard numerical value for optionality in a complex human society? If a policymaker cannot put a real number on O, the equation is functionally useless for real-world governance.
And a third reviewer attacks the originality, claiming redundancy. The AI questions whether the viability grammar is truly novel, or if it is simply repackaging 1950s cybernetics and 1970s resilience theory with a fresh coat of geometric paint and new acronyms.
But the absolute brilliance of this isn't just the intellectual honesty, it's the meta-application of the theory itself. By running this simulated hostile review, Dr. Sakely is literally executing the viability grammar on his own academic career.
Right, let's break down the mapping.
Okay, the constraint, C, of the scientific community is the peer review process. If your paper gets rejected for fatal flaws, your academic viability collapses. The disturbances, D, are the inevitable criticisms and counterarguments from rival scientists.
So instead of waiting for those disturbances to hit him in reality, Dr. Saley used the AI to massively enhance his systemic perception, P.
He perceived the fatal flaws in a virtual environment, which allowed him to deploy regulation, or rewriting and fortifying his arguments to protect the margin, M, of his scientific credibility.
He empirically demonstrated the efficacy of the viability functional by using it to ensure the survival of the paper describing the viability functional.
It is a breathtaking feedback loop, and it really previews the future of academic publishing. We are entering an era where AI is no longer just a fancy autocomplete or a data scraper. It is an adversarial collaborator. It serves as a hyperdimensional wind tunnel where scientists can stress test theoretical frameworks against simulated disturbances before they are ever exposed to the friction of the real world.
It forces researchers to radically expand the optionality of their hypotheses, resulting in science that is exponentially more robust upon arrival.
We have covered massive ground today. We've journeyed from the mechanical feedback loops of World War II anti-aircraft guns, through the adaptive cycles of boreal forests, into the strict topological mathematics of viability domains, all the way to AI-simulated peer review.
And the unifying thread through all of it is the viability grammar.
Whether you are prepping for a boardroom meeting, analyzing a political election, or just trying to manage your own stress levels, you now have the ultimate cheat sheet. You don't need to be overwhelmed by the complexity. You just need to map the variables.
Identify the strict constraints. Quantify your spatial margins. Assess the topological breadth of your optionality. Track the kinetic force of the disturbances. Calibrate the sensitivity of your perception. And ensure the mechanical capacity of your regulation.
Naming the exact location of the systemic failure is the very first step to surviving it. But as we wrap up this deep dive, there is one final, incredibly provocative implication that I want you to mull over. It's an anomaly that occurs when you apply this geometry to highly complex, socially interconnected human systems.
It introduces a layer of complexity that physics doesn't really have to deal with.
Right, because throughout this entire discussion, we have operated on the assumption that perception simply informs regulation. The headlights see the ice on the road, your brain processes the data, and your hands turn the wheel. The act of seeing the ice doesn't magically change the friction coefficient of the ice. Perception is a passive gathering of data.
But in deeply interconnected human networks, perception is rarely passive.
Think about the global financial system or the stock market. A bank is a viability system. It has strict constraints, its liquidity requirements, it has margins, its vault cash and reserve ratios. Now imagine a localized disturbance. A rumor begins circulating on social media that the bank is dangerously overleveraged and might fail.
The depositors, acting as the distributed perception network of the market, detect this informational disturbance.
But here is where the math gets terrifying. Their perception doesn't just inform their subsequent regulation. Their perception rapidly alters the fundamental constraints of the reality they are observing. Because 1 million depositors perceive that the bank is failing, they all engage in self-protective regulation simultaneously. They log into their apps and withdraw their funds in a massive bank run.
And in doing so, they instantly drain the bank's liquidity,
right,
dragging the system's margin down to absolute zero in a matter of hours, causing the exact catastrophic collapse they were initially just trying to perceive.
It is a sociological observer effect. The very act of measuring the fragility of the system injects catastrophic kinetic energy into the system. It's like quantum mechanics for human behavior. Mm-hmm. How do you govern a civilization? How do you manage global markets or political stability when the very act of the population watching the marble roll around the bowl radically warps the curvature of the bowl itself?
If human perception mathematically generates physical fragility, then the future of the viability grammar will require a completely new calculus of recursive, self-referential dynamics.
And that recursive frontier is why this paper isn't the final word on survival. It is the opening chapter of an entirely new scientific paradigm. So the next time you are faced with a complex, seemingly unmanageable crisis, whether in your organization, your community, or your own life, and you feel that creeping dread of the diagnostic muddy waters,
remember that you don't need a clean binary X-ray to understand what is failing.
You just need to speak the grammar of the murkiness. Measure the erosion of your margins, question the fidelity of your perception, and radically protect your capacity to regulate. Keep your X inside your C. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Keep mapping your viability landscapes, keep expanding your optionality, and we will catch you on the next one.